Ho, 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 hello, folks, and welcome once again to the festive fireside of the Great Library of Dreams. Come on in, dear friends. It's very chilly out there, isn't it? Let me get your coats and conduct you to your usual seat by the fire. Well, we're getting very close to the big day itself, and I thought it only right and proper at this stage of the season to have a story not just set at Christmas, but taking place over Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and Boxing Day too. And it is, if you will pardon the pun, a real Christmas cracker of a tale. It comes from a fellow called Sir Andrew Chaldecott, a man who spent most of his life working overseas. He worked in Malaya for many, many years, and became governor of firstly Hong Kong, and later Ceylon, now Sri Lanka. He wrote a great deal about Malaya and his time there, wrote books on its history too. It was a place very, very close to his heart. However, when he retired, he began writing ghost stories for his own pleasure and amusement, and produced two volumes of cracking tales, Not Quiet Ghosts in 1947 and Fires Burn Blue in 1948. Now, tonight's story, A Christmas Reunion, comes from that first collection, not exactly ghosts. And indeed, it's a line in this particular story that gives his first book its title. Furthermore, there is a link to the ghost stories of M.R. James as well. However, I'll let you discover that for yourself when you hear the tale. Like a lot of Sir Andrew's fiction, it demonstrates a deft imagination, a great command of language, and a certain touch of dark humour too. All of which means we have a rather jolly but pleasingly macabre festive ghost story. So then, dear friends, if you'd like to take your seats by the fire, let's pay a visit to a foggy London of yesteryear, where it is the night before Christmas. Christmas Reunion by Sir Andrew Chaldecott. 1. I cannot explain what exactly it is about him, but I don't like your Mr. Clarence Love, and I'm sorry you ever asked him to stay. Thus Richard Drayton to his wife Eleanor on the morning of Christmas Eve. But one must remember the children, Richard. You know what marvellous presents he gives them. Much too marvellous. He spoils them. Yet you'll have noticed that none of them likes him. Children have a wonderful intuition in regard to the character of grown-ups. What on earth are you hinting about his character? He's a very nice man. Drayton shuffled off his slippers in front of the study fire and began putting on his boots. I wonder, darling, whether you noticed his face just now at breakfast, when he opened that letter with the Australian stamps on. Yes, he did seem a bit upset, but not more so than you when you get my dressmaker's bill. Mrs. Drayton accompanied this sally with a playful pat on her husband's back as he leant forward to do up his laces. Well, Eleanor, all I can say is there's something very fishy about his Antipodean history. At 25, he left England a penniless young man, and hey presto, he returns a stinking plutocrat at 28. And how? What he's told you doesn't altogether tally with what he's told me. But, cutting out the differences, his main story is that he duly contacted old Nelson Joy, his maternal uncle, whom he went out to join, and that they went off together, prospecting for gold. They struck it handsomely, and then the poor old uncle gets a heart stroke or paralysis or something in the bush, and bids Clarence leave him there to die and get out himself before the food gives out. Arrived back in Sydney, Clarence produces a will under which he is the sole beneficiary, gets the court to presume old Joy's death, and bunks back here with the loot. Mrs. Drayton frowned. "I can see nothing wrong or suspicious about the story," she said, "but only in your telling of it." "No, no, in his telling of it. He never gets the details quite the same twice running, and I'm certain he gave a different topography of their prospecting expedition this year to what he did last. It's my belief that he did the uncle in, poor old chap." "Don't be so absurd, Richard, and please remember that he's our guest, and that we must be hospitable, especially at Christmas. Which reminds me, on your way to office, would you mind looking in at Harridge's and making sure that they haven't forgotten our order for their Santa Claus tomorrow? He's to be here at 7, then go to the Simpsons at 7:30, and to end up at the Joneses at 8. It's lucky our getting 3 households to share the expenses. Harridge's charge each of us only half their catalogue fee. If they could possibly send us the same Father Christmas as last year, it would be splendid. The children adored him. Don't forget to say, too, that he'll find all the crackers, hats, musical toys and presents inside the big chest in the hall, just the same as last year. What should we do nowadays without the big stores? One goes to them for everything." "We certainly do," Dayton agreed. "And I can't see the modern child putting up with the amateur Father Christmases we used to suffer from. I shall never forget the annual exhibition Uncle Bertie used to make of himself. Or the slippering I got when I stuck a darning needle into his behind under the pretense that I wanted to see if he was real. Well, so long, old girl. No, I won't forget to call in at Harridge's." 2. By the time the festive Christmas supper had reached the dessert stage, Mrs. Drayton fully shared her husband's regret that she had ever asked Clarence Love to be of the party. The sinister change that had come over him on the receipt of the letter from Australia became accentuated on the later arrival of a telegram which, he said, would necessitate his leaving towards the end of the evening to catch the 8:15 northbound express from King's Pancras. His valet had already gone ahead with the luggage, and, as it had turned so foggy, he announced his intention of following later by underground, in order to avoid the possibility of being caught in a traffic jam. It is strange how sometimes the human mind can harbour simultaneously 2 entirely contradictory emotions. Mrs. Drayton was consumed with the annoyance that any guest of hers should be so inconsiderate as to terminate his stay in the middle of a Christmas party, but was, at the same time, impatient to be rid of such a skeleton at the feast. One of the things she had found attractive in Clarence Love had been an unfailing fund of small talk, which, if not brilliant, was at any rate bright and breezy. He possessed also a pleasant and frequent smile, and, till now, had always been assiduous in his attention to her conversation. Since yesterday, however, he had turned silent, inattentive, and dour in expression. His presentation to her of a lovely emerald brooch had been unaccompanied by any greeting beyond an unflattering and perfunctory "Happy Christmas." He'd also proved unforgivably oblivious of the mistletoe, beneath which, with a careful carelessness, she stationed herself when she heard him coming down to breakfast. It was, indeed, quite mortifying, and when her husband described the guest as a busted balloon, she had neither the mind nor the heart to gainsay him. Happily for the mirth and merriment of the party, Drayton seemed to derive much exhilaration from the dumb discomfiture of his wife's friend, and Eleanor had never seen nor heard her husband in better form. He managed, too, to infect the children with his own ebullience, and even Miss Potterby, the governess, reciprocated his fun. Even before the entry of Father Christmas, it had become a noisy and almost rowdy company. Father Christmas's salutation, on arrival, was in rhymed verse, and delivered in a manner appropriate to pantomime. His lines ran thus:
To sons of peace Yule brings release from worry at this tide. But men of crime this holy time their guilty heads need hide. So never fear, ye children dear, but innocent sing Noel, for the holy rood shall save the good, and the bad be burned in hell. This is my carol, and Noel my parole.
There was clapping of hands at this, for there is nothing children enjoy so much as mummery, especially if it be slightly mysterious. The only person who appeared to dislike the recitation was Love, who was seen to stop both ears with his fingers at the end of the first verse and to look ill. As soon as he had made an end of the prologue, Santa Claus went ahead with his distribution of gifts and made many a merry quip and pun. He was quick in the uptake too, for the children put to him many a poser, to which a witty reply was always ready. The minutes, indeed, slipped by all too quickly for all of them, except Love, who kept glancing uncomfortably at his wristwatch and was plainly in a hurry to go. Hearing him mutter that it was time for him to be off, Father Christmas walked to his side and bade him pull a farewell cracker. Having done so, resentfully it seemed, he was asked to pull out the motto and read it. His hands were now visibly shaking, and his voice seemed to have caught their infection. Very falteringly, he managed to stammer out two lines of doggerel.
Reunited heart to heart, love and joy shall never part. And now, said Father Christmas, I must be making for the next chimney, and on my way, sir, I will see you into the underground.
So saying, he took Clarence Love by the left arm and led him with mock ceremony to the door, where he turned and delivered this epilogue.
Ladies and gentlemen, good night. Let not darkness you affright. Aught of evil here today, Santa Claus now bears away.
At this point, with sudden dramatic effect, he clicked off the electric light switch by the door, and by the time Drayton had groped his way to it in the darkness and turned it on again, the parlour maid, who was awaiting Love's departure in the hall, had let him both and Father Christmas out into the street.
Excellent, Mrs. Drayton exclaimed. Quite excellent. One can always depend on Harridges. It wasn't the same man they sent last year, but quite as good and more original, perhaps.
I'm glad he's taking Mr. Love away, said young Harold.
Yes, Dorothy chipped in. He's been beastly all day, and yesterday too, and his presents aren't nearly as expensive as last year.
Shut up, you sport children, the father interrupted. I must admit, though, that fellow was a wet blanket this evening. What was that nonsense he read out about reunion?
Miss Potterby had developed a pedagogic habit of clearing her throat audibly, as a signal demanding her pupil's attention to some impending announcement. She did it now, and parents, as well as children, looked expectantly towards her.
The motto was read by Mr. Love, she declared, was so palpably inconsequent, I took the liberty of appropriating it when he laid the slip of paper back on the table. Here it is, and this is what it actually reads. Be united heart to heart, love and joy shall never part. That makes sense, if it doesn't make poetry. Mr. Love committed the error of reading be united as reunited, and not observing the comma between the two lines.
Thank you, Miss Potterby. That, of course, explains it. How clever of you to have spotted the mistake and tracked it down.
Thus encouraged, Miss Potterby proceeded to further corrective edification.
You remarked just now, Mrs. Drayton, that the gentleman impersonating Father Christmas had displayed originality. His prologue and epilogue, however, were neither of them original, but corrupted versions of passages you will find in Professor Borlase's Synopsis of Nativity, Miracle and Morality Plays, published 2 years ago. I happen to be familiar with the subject, as the author is the first cousin of mine once removed.
How interesting, Dayton here broke in.
And now, Miss Potterby, if you will most kindly preside at the piano, we will dance Sir Roger de Coverley,
Come on, children, into the drawing room.
3.
On Boxing Day, there was no post and no paper. Meeting Mrs. Simpson in the park that afternoon, Mrs. Drayton was surprised to hear that Father Christmas had kept neither of his two other engagements.
It must have been that horrid fog, she suggested. But what a shame! He was even better than last year.
By which intelligence Mrs. Simpson seemed little comforted. Next morning, the second after Christmas, there were two letters on the Drayton's breakfast table. Both were from Harridge's. The first conveyed that firm's deep regret that their representative should have been prevented from carrying out his engagements in Pentland Square on Christmas night, owing to dislocation of traffic caused by the prevailing fog.
But he kept ours all right, Mrs. Drayton commented. I feel so sorry for the Simpsons and the Joneses.
The second letter cancelled the first, which had been written in unfortunate oversight of the cancellation of the order.
What on earth does that mean?
Mrs. Drayton ejaculated. Ask me another, returned her husband. Got their correspondence mixed up, I suppose. In contrast to the paucity of letters, the morning newspapers seemed unusually voluminous and full of pictures. Mrs. Drayton's choice of what to read in them was not that of a highbrow. The headline that attracted her first attention ran Christmas on Underground, and, among other choice items, she learned how, at Pentland Street Station, their own nearest, a man dressed as Santa Claus had been seen to guide and support an invalid, or possibly tipsy, companion down the long escalator. The red coat, mask and beard were afterwards found discarded in a passage leading to the emergency staircase. So even Santa's sobriety might be called into question. She was just about to retail this interesting intelligence to her husband when, laying down his own paper, he stared curiously at her and muttered,
"Good God! What on earth's the matter, dear?" "Very horrible thing, Eleanor. Clarence Love has been killed. Listen."
Here he resumed his paper and began to read aloud. "The body of a man who fell from the Pentland Street platform on Christmas night in front of an oncoming train has been identified as that of Mr. Clarence Love of 11 Playfair Mansions. There was a large crowd of passengers on the platform at the time, and it is conjectured that he fell backwards off it while turning to expostulate with persons exerting pressure at his back. Nobody, however, in the crush could have seen the exact circumstances of the said fatality."
"Hush, dear, here come the children. They mustn't know, of course. We can talk about it afterwards."
Drayton, however, could not wait to talk about it afterwards. The whole of the amateur detective within him had been aroused, and, rising early from the breakfast table, he journeyed by tube to Harridge's, where he was soon interviewing a departmental sub-manager. No, there was no possibility of one of their representatives having visited Pentland Square on Christmas evening. Our Mr. Droper had got hung up in the Shenton Street traffic block until it was too late to keep his engagements there. He'd come straight back to his rooms. In any case, he would not have called at Mr. Drayton's residence in view of the cancellation of the order the previous day. Not cancelled, but he took down the telephone message himself. Yes, here was the entry at the register. Then it must be the work of some mischief maker. It was certainly a gentleman and not a lady's voice. Nobody except he and Mr. Droper knew of the engagement at their end, so the practical joker must have derived his knowledge of it from someone in Mr. Drayton's household. This was obviously sound reasoning, and on his return home, Drayton questioned Mrs. Timmins, the cook, in the matter. One of them insurance gents had called on the morning before Christmas and had been told that none of us wanted no policies or such like. He had then turned conversational and asked what sort of goings-on there would be here for Christmas. Nothing, he was told, except old Father Christmas, as usual, out of Harridge's shop. Then he asked about visitors in the house and was told there were none except Mr. Love, who, judging by the tip what he had given Martha when he stayed last in the house, was a wealthy and open-handed gentleman. Little did she think when she spoke those words, as Mr. Love would forget to give any tips or boxes at Christmas, when they were most natural and proper. But perhaps he would think better on it by the new year and send a postal order. Drayton thought it unlikely, but deemed it unnecessary at this juncture to inform Mrs. Timmins of the tragedy reported in the newspaper. At luncheon, Mrs. Drayton found her husband unusually taciturn and preoccupied, but by the time they had come to the cheese, he announced importantly that he had made up his mind to report immediately to the police certain information that had come into his possession. Miss Porterby and the children looked suitably impressed, but knew better than to court a snub by asking questions. Mrs. Drayton took the cue admirably by replying, "Of course, Richard, you must do your duty." 4. The inspector listened intently and jotted down occasional notes. At the end of the narration, he complimented the informant by asking whether he had formed any theory regarding the facts he reported. Drayton most certainly had. That was why he had been so silent and absent-minded at lunch. His solution, put much more briefly than he expounded it to the inspector, was as follows. Clarence Love had abandoned his uncle and partner in the Australian bush, having returned to civilization, got the courts to presume the uncle's death, and taken probate of the will, under which he was sole inheritor. Love returned to England, a wealthy and still youngish man. The uncle, however, this was Drayton's theory, did not die after his nephew's desertion, but was found and tended by bushmen. Having regained his power of locomotion, he trekked back to Sydney, where he discovered himself legally dead and his property appropriated by Love and removed to England. Believing his nephew to have compassed his death, he resolved to take revenge into his own hands. Having dispatched a cryptic letter to Love, containing dark hints of impending doom, he sailed for the old country and ultimately tracked Love down to the Drayton's abode. Then, having in the guise of a travelling insurance agent ascertained the family's programme for Christmas Day, he planned his impersonation of Santa Claus. That his true identity, revealed by voice and accent, did not escape his victim, was evidenced by the latter's nervous misreading of the motto in the cracker. Whether Love's death in the underground was due to actual murder or to suicide enforced by despair and remorse, Drayton hazarded no guess. Either was possible under his theory. The inspector's reception of Drayton's hypothesis was less enthusiastic than his wife's. "If you'll excuse me, Mr. Drayton," said the former, "you've built a mighty lot on damn little. Still, it's ingenious and no mistake. I'll follow your ideas up, and if I call you in a week's time, I may have something to tell you, or one or two things, perhaps, to ask."
"Why, darling, how wonderful!" Mrs. Drayton applauded. "Now that you've pieced the bits together so cleverly, the whole thing's quite obvious, isn't it? What a horrible thing to have left poor old Mr. Joy to die all alone in the jungle. I never really liked Clarence, and I'm quite glad now that he's dead. But of course, we mustn't tell the children."
Inquiries of the Australian police elicited the intelligence that the presumption of Mr. Joy's death had long since been confirmed by the discovery of his remains in an old prospecting pit. There were ugly rumours and suspicions against his nephew, but no evidence on which to support them. On being thus informed by the inspector, Drayton amended his theory to the extent that the impersonator of Father Christmas must not have been Mr. Joy himself, as he was dead, but a bosom friend determined to avenge him. This substitution deprived the cracker episode, on which Drayton had imagined his whole story, of all relevance, and the inspector was quite frank about his disinterest in the revised version. Mrs. Drayton also rejected it. Her husband's original theory seemed to her more obviously right and conclusive even than before. The only amendment required, and that on a mere matter of detail, was to substitute Mr. Joy's ghost for Mr. Joy. Though, of course, one mustn't tell the children. "But," her husband remonstrated, "you know I don't believe in ghosts." "No, but your Aunt Cecilia does, and she is such a clever woman. By the way, she called in this morning and left you a book to look at."
"A book?"
"Yes, The Collected Ghost Stories of M.R. James."
But that stupid old dear knows that I have them all in the original editions. So she said, but she wants you to read the author's epilogue to the collection, which she says is most entertaining. It's entitled Stories I Have Tried to Write. She said that she'd sidelined a passage that might interest you. The book's on that table by you. No, not that one. The one with the black cover. Drayton picked it up and found the marked passage and read it aloud. There may be possibilities too in the Christmas cracker, if the right people pull it, and if the motto which they find inside has the right message on it. They will probably leave the party early, pleading indisposition. But very likely a previous engagement of long standing would be the more truthful excuse. There is certainly, Drayton commented, some resemblance between James's idea and our recent experience. But he could have made a perfectly good yarn out of that theme without introducing ghosts. His wife's mood at that moment was for compromise rather than controversy. Well, darling, she temporised, perhaps not exactly ghosts.
This podcast was produced by Mr. Jim Moon, with music from the Eldritch Light Orchestra. If you enjoyed this show, please consider leaving us a review or a rating so other people can find it. If you really like the show, consider buying us a coffee at coffee.com/hypnagoria or becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/hypnagoria, where subscribers can get exclusive new shows every month and access the Patreons only podcasting vault. For more nonsense, call into our site, hypnagoria.com, where you can find all manner of essays and articles on the weird and the wonderful, plus my other podcasts, plus links to YouTube and all the usual social media gubbins. This has been a Great Library of Dreams production.